Hi, and welcome to this edition of Fresh Hope for Mental Health. Our mission here at Fresh Hope for Mental Health is to empower you to live well in spite of your mental health challenge by sharing insights through interviews, practical tools for living well, encouragement and courage for overcoming all from a Christian perspective. And now, here's your host, Pastor Brad Hafes.
Hello, my friend, and welcome to Fresh Hope for Mental Health. I'm Brad Hafes, your host. Our purpose here on Fresh Hope for Mental Health is to empower you to live a faith-filled, rich, and full life in spite of having a mental health diagnosis. And do I have a guest for you today here in my studio? My own psychiatrist, Dr. Michael Egger. He is my doctor, and he's also on our board of directors for Fresh Hope for Mental Health, as well as he is practicing here in Omaha and is with CHI and has been practicing psychiatry for how many years, Doc?
43.
Only 43, huh? But, you know, it's interesting how God works, because it was when I was first diagnosed, I had seen a counselor in an office. And when I needed a doctor, I asked him, well, would I need a psychiatrist? Who would you recommend? And he recommended Dr. Egger, who happened to be in his office, worked in the same office. And it's been 23 years ago now, I think. Are we going to celebrate our silver anniversary or something? But Dr. Egger, tell us just a little bit about yourself and your family. And
well, I've been in practice now 43 years, exactly the same period of time I've been married.
Ah.
And my wife and I have two children, our son 30 and daughter 34. No grandchildren yet. We're both from the Midwest area. I'm from Lincoln originally, my wife from Omaha.
Oh, I didn't realize you were from Lincoln.
Huh? We've actually lived here all of our working lives, apart from 2 years I was in the Navy in Chicago.
Oh, I didn't know you were in the Navy either. Yeah. Huh, okay. Were you already a doctor when you were in the Navy?
Yes, I was in the Navy Reserve some 9 years, but I was on active duty for 2 years in the late 70s at the Naval Hospital at Great Lakes.
Oh, okay. So you said that you have two children,
yes.
Right? Grown children. And what are your hobbies? I know that you like books.
Well, I like books too much. My house is full of them, and my wife and daughter forbade me to bring any more home. So I solved the problem by having my office designed with more bookshelves, so I have them shipped there. But now it's getting full, so I can't really retire because I have no place to put the books in the office. So I'm sort of hemmed in by my own excesses, I guess. Reading, and I enjoy collecting antiques.
Ah, okay. Didn't know that either. I'm finding out a few things here. Well, let's just hop into the whole mental health issues and things like that. And by the way, if you're listening to this podcast and you would like us to answer questions in regards to issues that you're wondering about and would like to ask a doctor, you can email me at pastorbrad@freshhope.us. And who knows, we'll maybe do another podcast and I'll just do them with the questions that you all write in with Dr. Egger. Anyway, obviously, I trust him. I know he's very good. Anyway, let's just hop in. Talk just a little bit with me about resiliency. How is it that one person bounces back with mental health issues and lives fairly well, and another person maybe just struggles? They have these ongoing struggles. I know there's a variance in how severely somebody has a disorder, you know, and it's not just bipolar, but whatever it might be. But why, what about resiliency? What is it about that? Why do some people come back?
Part of it has to do with the severity of the illness and its frequency of recurrence. A lot of it, though, has to do with genetic linkage, not only of the illness, but of overall health characteristics. Some people are just more energetic than others.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are in better health than others, not just mental, but cardiac, diabetic, all the other illnesses that can be developed. Those affect resiliency. I think part of the difficulty in recovering from an episode of mental illness is we do put a good deal of emphasis upon, of course, medications and also social interaction and maintaining their support group. But we don't pay a lot of attention to general health issues such as exercise, nutrition, vitamins. Here in the Midwest, our daylight recedes rapidly in the autumn and winter. And I am absolutely insistent on all of my patients having vitamin D supplements for the winter and use full spectrum light for 2 or 3 hours a day where they spend their time. Perhaps they work on their computer, read, watch TV, whatever. It's not an issue if you live in Texas. Here it is. If you're in Minnesota, it's really an issue, and Canada even worse. So I think we tend to ignore or overlook some of these very basic physiologic health issues. I sometimes will have vitamin levels done on patients. Quite a few people are vitamin D deficient in this area. Vitamin B12 deficiency is very commonly associated with poor resiliency and low energy. And vitamin B12 is pretty often deficient around here also. So I think these issues should be looked at with basic exercise, also dietary issues. People in our culture typically have an abysmally poor diet in terms of not only general health, but even in mood, well-being, and energy. And sometimes I will actually refer them to a dietitian to work on some of those things.
Interesting. One of the things I'm hearing you say is that just your general overall energy, maybe with your personality type or your just the way people are wired, has a lot to do with it, huh?
It does. Some people, and if you look at their family histories for 2 or 3 generations, you can often pick up some people are just blessed with a lot of energy, good physiology, longevity often goes along with that, and some people are not. But whatever you are gifted with genetically, you can make the most of that with some fairly common sense rules of exercise, nutrition, light exposure, and the like.
Sure. Sometimes I wonder how much practicing discipline in our lives has a lot to do with getting better, because it's so easy to yield to the depression and just not be disciplined and just say, I can't do that, I can't do this, and so we just don't push past some of it.
That's true. Discipline, particularly for daily routine, is one of the most commonly overlooked phenomena in recovery from almost any mental illness and also quite a few physiologic illnesses. Maintaining a very set daily routine is optimum for good physical and mental health.
Yeah.
Disturbing that routine is problematic, and that's one of the reasons why patients I treat with affective disorders that have to travel for their work, if they are traveling more than one time zone, this is a bit of a problem because it disturbs the natural biorhythm because of the sleep alterations. The other factor, which is even more frequently a problem, are patients that have to shift. They work a week of days, a week of evenings, a week of nights, and they're expected to move their sleep cycle around every week or two. And I warn them right up front, this is an impossibility. If you keep maintaining the cycle, you're going to feel maybe a little better and never get really well. If you're beyond age 25, it just is not a plausible way to maintain a mental and physical health, which makes me very unpopular among my night dwellers who yes. work midnight to 6 a.m. or 7 a.m., and I tell them, well, fine, your day's off. You need to follow exactly the same sleep schedule. You mean I have to go to bed at 9 in the morning and sleep till 5 on my day's off? Yes, that's what I mean. Well, is that crazy? Yeah, it probably is. Everybody wants to go to the store, get the oil changed in the car, all that stuff. But if you're going to maintain mental as well as physical health, you cannot sleep days, 5 days a week, and nights, 2 nights a week, and make it work. It just doesn't work.
Right.
And a lot of my patients do have to shift their work schedule, days to evenings to nights. And I try to get them out of it all possible, because they're never going to have basic physical and mental well-being on that kind of rotating schedule. It just doesn't happen.
Right. Well, it's just like going on to the cycle of sleep, no sleep, wrong sleep, not enough sleep. That would cause me to get sick pretty fast. It just would cause me to go all over the place, I suspect. How much do you think undealt with emotional issues, which I always tell people, everybody's got emotional issues. Everybody's got baggage. And if you don't think you do, let me come and live with you for 24 hours. I'll trigger you. How much do you think that plays into resiliency and mental health when the brain chemistry's messed up and the emotional issues have yet to be dealt with? You know, there's a play in there of...
It has quite a bit to do with it. People with chronic unresolved emotional tensions tend to never get back a really good energy level. Their expenditure of energy on worry and fear and apprehension is much higher than average. Mm-hmm. Their sleep pattern is more often disrupted. So even if they have a physiologic mental illness, such as a bipolar disorder, and you get through the more acute phases of that, you still have this underlying substrate that's not ideal for good emotional and physical recovery. Those patients really need ongoing psychotherapy, talking therapy. Those kind of unresolved emotional conflicts, there's no medication for that. Mm-hmm. There's no silver bullet, silver pill for the purpose. And that's why the psychotherapy component for them is especially important.
Yeah, yeah. Which kind of plays into the whole issue of, for instance, I think trauma plays a major factor for people in even developing a mental health issue. So many people don't even talk about trauma.
That's true, partly out of fear and social acceptance. Since I practice in Omaha, I have a lot of PTSD patients who are military retirees because mm-hmm. of our large military population here. These are generally people pretty strong physically and emotionally, no history of mental health problems, long service in the military, and then have some kind of traumatic experience, usually in this population, battlefield. And you get a constellation of underlying emotional conflicts that trigger a huge amount of physiologic response in terms of hypervigilance, nightmares, flashbacks, angry outbursts, sometimes mimicking bipolar episodes, although it's really a separate illness, but it mm-hmm. kind of can look the same at sure. first. Those patients need more, not just the medication management, the acute symptoms, but they must deal emotionally with the underlying conflicts if they're going to actually achieve a state of well-being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How challenging is it to make an accurate diagnosis for you, or in general for doctors?
That's an interesting question. I don't find it so difficult because I'm older than dirt. I've been doing this for so long. A friend of mine died a few years ago, said a psychiatrist who's really good at what he does should know the diagnosis within 2 minutes of talking to the person.
Hmm.
I think that's pretty close to the truth. Now, that sounds a little arrogant, but it's probably accurate because over time, you have a sort of filtering system, mm-hmm. and you go through that very, very fast, listening to a patient even for a few minutes. The other thing that I find helpful is that, you know, if I see a patient that comes to me with the first time they've had some illness go on, they've not been treated, they've never seen a psychiatrist, they've never gone to their family doctor, they've never taken a medication, I will immediately send them out and have them bronzed. I want to use them as a doorstop because I never see a patient like that ever.
Right, right.
And that's because of the evolution of healthcare, where everybody has to go to their family doctor and try two or three or four or five now medications before they ever see the psychiatrist. So I have this fairly lengthy history, which generally is unsuccessful, or they wouldn't have come in the first place, of what they've tried, what hasn't worked, what the doctors thought was wrong.
Which is already
sometimes correct, but not always.
Yeah.
And so I've got this very long history of response and failure, mostly failure, to look at as part of the evaluation. So I think by the time I see them, it's not really difficult.
I will say that I've seen a lot of people in Fresh Hope groups where they'll say they really are struggling with depression. There's a young man that I'm particularly thinking of, and that he has depression and anxiety. And then he also acts out a lot. And he, every time he talks about the depression, he says, I've got a lot of racing thoughts. And I know that there's been a fair amount of people, and I've sent them to you, that have had bouts of depression over and over and over, and then end up having a diagnosis of, really, it's not depression, it's bipolar type 2, and all of a sudden they're living a great life, you know, or much better life. And I oftentimes think of this young man. So there's really two questions I have. One, why is it that bipolar type 2 is so easily missed for people that, you know, really need to consider? And what is it that they don't tell their doctor about the times they feel normal? And that ties into the whole concept of mania. I know that you and I've talked about mania, and you use different terms than what I hear a lot of other doctors use. And I really appreciate the fact that you use the terms that you do. So if you could just address those two issues, it's a long question, but of the mania, what is it? What does it look like? And how does that play into bipolar type 2 and the misdiagnosis of bipolar type 2?
All right. Well, it's really not a long question. It's about four questions, but I'll try to go through them. I think the first one you introduced was patients are diagnosed with depression and the bipolar component is not always picked up. And that's really quite simple to answer, because the patient with bipolar disorder, whether type 1 or type 2 or depression, presents, they present the same way. Mm-hmm. The depression presents pretty much with the same group of symptoms: sadness, low energy, poor concentration, too much or too little sleep, appetite increase or decrease, sometimes weepiness or despair. We call it major depression if these went on more than 2 weeks, which is kind of a misnomer. Most of the time it does, or nobody does anything about it. Mm-hmm. But people present with that, so it gets diagnosed as depression. And whatever variety, major depression or bipolar depression, you pretty much treat it the same way. Mm-hmm. The change comes when the depression recurs. Then you start to look at, well, why did it recur? Mm-hmm. Maybe it was financial, maybe a marriage, a death in the family. If there's some kind of outside circumstance that you connect it to, you tend to leave it as a depressive episode. But over time, and this is where the psychiatrist has the advantage, because generally the first time or two, they go to their family doctor, they get some medicine and usually get a little better at least. But then over time, it seems to keep coming back. And that's where you start to look at two factors, what I call periodicity and family chronology. Periodicity is a pattern of recurrence. If their bouts of depression have come on each time because of some personal issue going on in life, some loss, some crisis, that's one thing. But many of these patients, no, the depression just pops up. Mm-hmm. Nothing's wrong. Nothing's going wrong in life. Everything's fine, but here it is. And then after a while, it just goes away. Mm-hmm. Then it comes back. And then you start to look, well, is there a predictable frequency? Mm-hmm. Sometimes there is and sometimes not. What you do see is a pattern of recurrence without outside stressors. Even more precise is if you do get a pattern of predictability, and if some patients have this, yes, every 4 months they're going to have this. Mm-hmm. I saw a patient just the other day in a nursing home, tried to commit suicide, a patient I've treated in the past. Her son told the nursing staff when they brought her to the hospital, yes, happens every December. And it has for three generations in that family.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's another thing you look at is the family history. Is this depression, is there a sibling, a parent, a grandparent with similar pattern? Not necessarily treated, because if you get beyond our generation, I'm almost 70, in the old days people didn't get much treatment. But the relatives may know, grandma went to bed for 2 months every 6 months, and we had to force feed her. You'll have old anecdotal information like that to go on. But you look for two things, the recurring predictability and also a multi-generational family history. Mm-hmm. Now, the difference between bipolar 1 and bipolar 2 is really quite simple. The presence of mania or hypomania. Mm-hmm. Bipolar 2 patients, they have their depressed episodes and they kind of come back to normal, maybe just a little bit on the cheerful side, but not much. They're just basically back normal for a while. Bipolar 1 patients become too high. Mm-hmm. And we used to call it euphoria. I mean, you know, cheerful, giddy, silly, spend too much money, drink too much, sexually promiscuous, go to the casinos, all that kind of thing. And that does happen, but more often it's just an increase in energy. Stay up half the night, vacuum the house 4 times, do a lot of physical stuff like housework just to wear off the energy, mm-hmm. sleep too little, generally eat less and maybe lose a little weight, and sometimes very irritable. We typically think of people who are in mania or hypomania as just cheerful and giddy and silly, sometimes, but not always. Sometimes they're just mean and nasty mm-hmm. and get really irritable, edgy. Another thing happens in our culture today, which is a little new, and it's because of the electronic age. We've always had patients with mania and hypomania that indulged in a sexually promiscuous behavior or gambling. And now that's really easy. We've got pornographic sites on all the computer screens, all kinds of gambling sites, all kinds of indulgent behavior. You don't even have to go out of your house to do now. You know, you sit there on your computer and do it. That has opened up a whole new spectrum of misadventure for these patients mm-hmm. that can lead them to, you know, horrible social and financial consequences. But there is not so much a cheerful, but a driven quality to the behavior that separates the bipolar 1 and the bipolar 2 patient. Again, you try to look for predictability. Do these episodes, low or high, occur in a certain frequency and pattern? Mm-hmm. It is not common to have one depressed episode, one upper episode, one depressed, one upper, very nice cycle. I would say maybe 1 in 10 patients will have that, very rare. Mm-hmm. Much more common are the depressed episodes.
Right, for both types.
Both types. And even for the bipolar 1 that has mania, the depressed episodes almost always are much more common and much longer, generally lasting a few months, where the highs last usually only a few weeks, if that. Our ability to treat the highs is probably better than our ability to treat the lows in terms of blocking them. The newer classes of medications are pretty effective at lessening the highs and maintaining mood stability and concentration. Blocking the depressions is a little less successful. Mm-hmm. We do have medications available to do that and often are effective, but I would say maybe a little less so than blocking the highs, which is unfortunate because the depressed episodes are much more common, much more frequent. And of course, for the bipolar 2 patient, that's all they really have.
Mm-hmm. What I hear a lot of people say is when you ask them, so you've had depression all of your life, bouts of it, right? And they'll say something like, well, I was taking medicine, it was working, and suddenly it wasn't working. Could that be, in fact, a cycle of depression that came on? In other words, the medicine seemed like it was working, that they have had a cycle of depression and the depression lessened and the medicine seemed like it was working, and then all of a sudden get a very severe depression cycle or episode of depression, and now that medicine's not enough. I mean, can it be that instead of just the medicine not working?
Oh, absolutely. Especially if you have a partial recovery from an episode of depression, but not complete. You're maybe 50, 60% better. And then go on to get another episode, the medication may fail at that point, even with dosage changes, and require really extensive alteration. You're really asking, is the failure of the medication causing the next depressed episode? Probably not, but it's not enough to block it either.
Right, not enough to block it, yep. The other thing is that I hear people say, if I ask them, have you ever asked your doctor about bipolar type 2? They'll say, well, I've never had mania. You know, I've never done all these crazy things. It's my understanding that with bipolar type 2, you could have just one time of having a bit more energy.
That's perfectly true. Bipolar 2 patients, almost by definition, do not have mania. At most, they may have a little bit slight mania once or twice. Mostly, they just come back into normal range.
Mm-hmm.
So they never act bizarre. They don't do ridiculous things. At most, when you go through their history carefully, you can get a period of a few months that they were at least average or maybe a little bit better than normal, but not much more than that. It's often very subtle. And you really need a history from close relative, spouse, parent, sibling, because oftentimes that subtle mood improvement, the patient is so little aware of, a close family member, spouse, will notice it more.
Mm-hmm.
You really, in getting these histories of the low periods, the normal periods, and any real cycle, you really want to talk to their closest family member or spouse or child. They'll probably give you a more accurate history than the patient themselves is aware of.
Right. That's why I always tell people, if you really want to get better, make sure to give access to your closest loved ones, to your doctor and the doctor to them, because they're going to be able to tell the doctor things that we can't, because our own perception many times is off. I mean, or we don't remember. Would it be fair to say, or would it be accurate to say, if you're continually having bouts of depression in your life, you really need to ask your doctor about the possibility of bipolar type 2, or at least to introduce a mood stabilizer into the picture?
Yes, I think so. If you have a second depressed episode, especially if there's no particular cause for it outside you, there's nothing wrong in life, you're not going bankrupt or divorced or problems like that, but you have a second episode, you need to think about that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the doctor needs to be looking at your family history, who else in the family has this, does anybody?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you need to think beyond the usual classes of antidepressants to those drugs that are identified as mood stabilizers to lessen likelihood of future depressions. And those are really two groups. One group are anticonvulsants, originally developed for epilepsy of various kinds. The other group are the neuroleptic class, which were mostly developed originally for schizophrenia, although several of them, particularly the newer drugs, are more effective for depression and blocking depression than they are for schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm. Over the years, you and I've had interesting conversations, and one of them that I find fascinating is when you talk about the connection between the electrical system in the brain, or the idea that mood stabilizers, the anticonvulsant ones, have to do with convulsions, migraines, and also the mania.
You're basically asking the connection between electrical overactivity in certain areas of the brain, and that is seems to be a driving force in mood disorders, epilepsy, and migraine. One of our old drugs for treating mood disorders, Depakote, is an anticonvulsant. It is very effective in blocking both depression and mania. It's also very effective as an anticonvulsant, commonly used for that, for grand mal epilepsy. And it's also very commonly used for migraine. Very good for migraine, for the same reasons, probably. Some of the others, like Topamax, Lamictal, and the like, the same is true, although they're less likely to block mania than depression, but they're very good for the depression and for migraine as well. So there is an overlap, and it's because the electrical activity in the brain in different areas can produce the manifestation of mood changes or seizures or migraine.
Yep, that's what I was talking about.
And you know, historically, we do use the electroconvulsive treatments, which yes. produce a seizure. And that's why that treatment was developed. Back in the 1930s, it was noted in state hospitals that patients ill with severe thought disorders or severely depressed that happened to have epilepsy, when they had a grand mal seizure, they got better for a few days.
Mm-hmm.
And doctors begin to wonder, if we could reproduce the seizure, would that actually help their mood disorder?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the whole concept of electroconvulsive treatments developed. It actually started using an inhaling gas called endocline back in the 20s and 30s that produced a seizure, but was very difficult to control and tended to leak, causing the staff to participate in the experience. So that was rather quickly given up. And the electroconvulsive method was developed in 1937, I think, by Soletti and Bini in Italy. And it really is no different today than it was then, except now we have all kinds of fancy machinery to hook the patient up to entertain them while they're getting their treatment. Mm-hmm. But it's basically principally the same. But that's how it was discovered, that if you happen to have epilepsy and you have a bad bout of depression and you just happen to have a seizure, your mood gets better for a while.
Yeah.
Based strictly on an external observation.
That's fascinating. Yeah. Yeah, because you wonder what it'll be like 25, 35, 50 years from now. How much more we'll know about that. It's fascinating.
Well, one of the things I think we're going to see in research, which I imagine patients find a little frightening, but I think it's exciting to think about. Right now, one of the treatments for refractory epilepsy, also a treatment for Parkinson's disease, is the use of electrical probes into the brain that fire with something like a pacemaker attached. And I think we're going to see that used in depressive disorders in the future.
Isn't that something?
My son works for Medtronics in Minneapolis, where that's the sort of thing they're developing and working on. I think all the people that find the idea of putting something in their brain a little frightening, but I think for patients with severe refractory depression, we're probably going to see that widely used in the future. Pretty much like people have a pacemaker for their heart disease now and don't think too much about
right.
it. I think we're going to see that probably used for depression in the next generation.
Yeah. Let's just totally switch gears here. Talk to me a little bit about this disconnect with the Christian church and understanding mental health issues. You know, if somebody has Tourette's syndrome or mental handicap, we understand that they're not going to act normal. We understand that they're going to say things they shouldn't say, do things that they shouldn't do. And we get it that, you know, the brain has something to do with this. Why is it that there's such a disconnect of understanding that people's behaviors have a lot to do with their mental illness and that they're directly connected?
I think for two reasons. First of all, the acceptance probably within the Christian faith that mood, emotions, thoughts are influenced by the brain is much less than the notion that seizure disorder, Tourette's, or whatever else would be influenced by it. There's, I think, a confusion between the mind and the spirit. And if your spirit is renewed by the Word of God and the practice of the Christian faith, that should govern your emotions. No, it doesn't. Your emotions are part of your physical aspect, the brain, the mind, the body. I think Christians confuse this difference between the spirit and the mind. And believing that the spirit should govern any kind of behavioral aberration seems to be a rejection of principles of faith or application of faith. So you're either not practicing what you should or you've fallen into sin. I think that's the basic origin of the difficulty, is this lack of acceptance or understanding of the human mind as physiologically impacted. And I try to give patients, or not only patients, but people I'm talking in groups, a couple of examples. We've all had the experience of seeing somebody drunk. Now, is that a spiritual matter? Well, drunkenness is certainly not of God, but it's basically the physiology of the brain involved. Now, you can get the same kind of phenomena by somebody who's diabetic. Their sugar suddenly goes too high or drops too low. They act like a drunken person, indistinguishable. Mm-hmm. You can't tell it apart. Is there anything wrong with them spiritually? No. Their brain and their behavior is directly impacted by their blood sugar. Another example that most people have experienced, either themselves or had a family member, is having some kind of surgery, and you're waking up on the anesthetic, and you're cussing and screaming, using foul languages, hitting out at your family and the nurse. So what is wrong with you spiritually? Well, nothing, really. You're under the influence of a noxious gas that's clearing from your system. That's normally physiologic response physically and mentally to the chemical. So when you look at it in that way, you have three examples: ordinary drunkenness, diabetic coma or hypoglycemic coma, or post-anesthesia confusion, nothing to do with anything spiritually particularly, and yet producing aberrations in thinking and behavior. And I think we need to look at mental illness in much of that same context, because most of the time it is. There are people who have emotional conflicts that are not really mentally ill. There are people who have spiritual conflicts. Those are not mental illness. But I think we have a tendency not to want to look at mental illness as a biological condition.
Mm-hmm. That your brain actually is messing up on you.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
I liken that to if I was asleep at night and somebody came in and injected methamphetamines into me, or however they might do it, I'm not going to act normal. And that's somewhat of what my brain does when it's not on medicine. Could even do it on medicine, I suppose, but hopefully to much lesser degrees. But you're not going to act normal.
That's perfectly true. You know, some of the very original research on thought disorders like schizophrenia and mood disorders like bipolar back in the 1950s were done giving research individuals amphetamines or LSD.
Mm-hmm.
I had a good friend and mentor who took his training at Maudsley in London, one of the great psychiatric hospitals, mm-hmm. way back in the 1950s. They were doing experiments then with it. Mm-hmm. That's how we learned a little bit about thought disorders by response to amphetamine.
Mm. That's interesting. I always repeat what you told me once about the fact that if you want to have someone experience a little bit about what mania is like, just keep them from having sleep, lots of caffeine, taking steroids, and how agitated you feel on those. And you've said to me that if you do all those things, sooner or later, you can induce kind of a...
Oh, absolutely. You get enough sleep deprivation and give them lots of caffeine, and you can trigger a psychotic episode very easily. Another phenomenon you mentioned are the use of steroids. Of course, this happens with infections, but especially with patients with chronic lung disease that get bronchitis and have to be on substantial doses of steroids. I always tell them, you can either get depressed, you can get giddy, or you can get confused. And mm-hmm. some of them get absolutely psychotic and hallucinate from the steroids. Yeah. Can't help it. Is there anything wrong with them spiritually? No. It's a simple chemical effect of the drug, although they have to have it for their breathing. But the steroids are a very classic example of producing either thought or mood disorders very quickly, chemically.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, people who have a mood disorder should be very careful with steroids.
They're going to be more sensitive, yes. But you can get those kinds of confusion and mood changes in perfectly normal folks just from the steroids alone. But yes, if you have a mood or a thought disorder, your sensitivity to those classes of drugs is going to be much greater. And I always warn those patients, if you have to take the steroids, okay, but let me know. The second is the street drugs are really, really dangerous for them.
Oh, yeah.
much more so than the average young teenager who wants to experiment. They're at much greater danger for really bad reactions.
Oh, yeah. The guys in the jail, I was talking to them just yesterday about what pot can do and what can happen when you have bipolar disorder, for instance, and smoke pot. And it's interesting how they just don't want to hear it because pot to them is benign. It's, you know, it doesn't do anything to them. And, oh, yeah, it does, you know.
Most of these people don't realize that the marijuana bought on the streets today is very much stronger, more potent than 20 years ago because it's purified. Also, it tends to be laced with everything from other street drugs to strychnine. And you really don't know what you're getting. The old question, if you can't trust your pusher, who can you trust? Well, that's a legitimate point. But the marijuana, and I see patients coming with this now, that we're seeing today is much more dangerous and toxic than what we saw 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah. Well, as we close here, how about just giving some encouragement to someone who's diagnosed with a mental health issue? You know, we didn't even get into some topics we could, and we will do this again because, you know, what do you do if your doctor's not listening to you? What, you know, things like that, which we don't have time for anymore. Talk to the person who's just been newly diagnosed or has been diagnosed and they're frustrated, to give them hope and to give them some encouragement, especially connecting the faith component to it.
I think they always need to look to Christ as a source of their healing. People tend to look to their medications and their doctors as a source of healing. No. No, we treat and alleviate symptoms. There actually are very, very few medical illnesses of any kind that are actually cured. Most of them are medical interventions that enable the body's natural healing processes to operate. That's how 99% of medical treatment of all conditions works. We are more effective now than in the past in having methods of alleviating the temporary symptoms so people can recover and function normally. And, you know, I can think of, you know, notable examples throughout history of people who've lived with and overcome, oh, particularly severe bouts of depression and managed to function to normal or even extraordinary degrees. Oliver Cromwell, the 17th century English politician, military leader, was one of those. And recently, Sir Winston Churchill, who described his depressions as his great black beast that would come on periodically. When he was not depressed, he was enormously creative, wrote volume after volume of magnificent literature, plus participating in government for 50 years. But talked about his great black beast and yet lived as rich and full of life as anyone could possibly imagine doing.
Right.
So that's entirely possible to do. The idea of having a mental illness, there's no such thing as a mental illness. It's a physiologic illness that affects the brain. And I think
like
maybe people should think about it in that way.
Absolutely. Well, that's very insightful. You know, I was just looking at the amount of time we've gone on this podcast, and I got to tell you, it's twice as long as normal, and I was not bored during it, and I was, wow, we've been going 48 minutes already. That's amazing. No matter what, I always find it fascinating to hear what you have to say about these things, because it's very intellectual as well as the spiritual. I know they're connected for you, and that's what I trust in you. That's what I really appreciate. And so thank you for being here today. And like I said, we'll do this again. Certainly, if you're listening to this, you can send in questions. And like I said at the beginning, send in some questions to us. We'll address those in the next podcast with Dr. Egger. And again, thank you, Dr. Egger.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. Well, my friend, that concludes this episode of Fresh Hope for Mental Health. I hope it's been helpful to you. Like I said, we'd really like to hear from you. Email us comments or questions and insights, and we'll answer them on our next program. We'd like to connect with you through social media. You can find us all over the place on social media or our YouTube channel, Also, would you do me a favor? If you're listening to this podcast through iTunes, would you please write a review, an honest review of the program? It just helps us be found for other iTunes users. Also, just tell your friends about this program. We'd love to have them connect with us also. So until the next time, may the Lord fill you with His hope, fresh and new daily. I'm Brad Haves, your host, and this has been another edition of Fresh Hope for Mental Health.
Thank you for listening to Fresh Hope for Mental Health. If you have an opportunity, please review, share, and subscribe to the Fresh Hope for Mental Health podcast on iTunes or on the service that you use. We encourage you to share our podcast on social media with your friends and family. Previous podcasts of Fresh Hope for Mental Health can be found at freshhopeformentalhealth.com, iHeartRadio, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes. Fresh Hope is one of the leading networks of faith-based peer support groups internationally. For more information about Fresh Hope, go to freshhope.us.